think of today's America and you think of a country drowning in debt. From the nation itself to the personal loans of individual consumers, America is in the hole. But how did we get that way? What forces shaped lending practices in America? And how can we put ourselves back in the black? And where do income equality and wage stagnation come into the picture? That's our topic this hour. I'm Veronica Rickard, keeping you company this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. And our guest this hour is Lewis Hyman. He's an assistant professor in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell University, and the author of the book Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. And as always, we're looking forward to taking your phone calls this morning. Where do you think America's red ink came from? And why do you think, or what do you think we need to do to pull out of it? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Lewis Hyman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, you write that lending in America has always existed. It's just that in its earliest forms, it seems like it was sort of shoved off to the margins of society in the beginning. What happened?
Well, I think that's an important question. I think there is a way in which we think that debt is a recent invention. Well, there's two ways we think about it. We either think it only began in the 1970s or it has existed forever in the way that it exists today. And in fact, neither story is true. What actually happened was that at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, there was a titanic shift in our economy where debt, through changes in law, which relaxed usury laws, and changes in the economy through the invention of the car, through the invention of the finance company, that suddenly it became profitable to lend to consumers. And it's this shift in the law, it's this shift in the profitability that really drives the increase in debt at the beginning of the 20th century and eventually leads to our economy today.
Well, in simplistic terms, as I understand it from your book, I mean, basically what happens is that America stopped making stuff. And because we stopped making stuff that was profitable, we stopped investing in things. Manufacturing tanked. Is that right?
It's basically true, so that it becomes more profitable to lend people money than to make people things. And when it becomes more profitable, it's not a moral story. My book isn't about blaming people or saying that we've become lazy or decadent. It's about trying to understand the forces behind the change, understanding the money behind the change, why it became more profitable to lend people money than to invest in a factory. Every dollar invested in consumer debt was a dollar not invested in a factory that could provide jobs to people.
You say it's not about blaming people, but in our political world right now, that's very much what's going on. Everyone's pointing fingers. The people on the bottom of the heap are saying, you know, look at the rich upstairs. They're doing something wrong. And it's this kind of endless bitter circle going on. And some shift had to have happened. We know when you're talking about the profitability of investing no longer in manufacturing, but in debt, for instance, in credit. Why did that happen?
It happened simply because it became more profitable, so that it's not the story of tricksters and hucksters and liars. And there's a sucker born every minute, right? I mean, there have always been people who try to defraud people. This is nothing new. What's new is that these hucksters have so much money to play with. What's new is that there's so much money to invest. And that question, why there's so much money at the top waiting to be invested, is really what my story is about. It's about the rise of inequality. It's about the rise of new ways to invest money and not trying to say this individual is responsible for all of this, but to understand the structures that made that individual so powerful and have so much money at his or her hands to play with.
Well, so you're starting to touch on income inequality, and I know that's a topic in a movie that you're featured in that's going to be coming out called The Flaw. So let's talk about income inequality. For starters, what does that mean, and why does it matter?
I think it's been shocking over the last 40 years how much more money is concentrated at the top of our society than at the bottom. There's actually a new paper out by Dan Ariely, which looks at the way in which Americans think income is distributed in America. And it turns out that Americans think that the distribution of income across our society is much more even than it actually is. In fact, nearly all the wealth is concentrated in the top 10%. And then in the top 10%, nearly all the wealth is concentrated in the top 1%, and so on. This is very important for our economy because the way in which people, average people, middle-class people, not even poor people, but middle-class people spend their money is very different than the way in which people at the top of the distribution spend their money. In the middle, people spend their money on services. If they get a dollar, they tend to spend it on services. They tend to buy manufactured goods. But if you give a dollar to someone at the top, they're going to save it, which sounds good. But then you try to think, well, what does it mean to save money? Where does that money get invested? And that's part of where this problem comes from. Because if no one's able to buy manufactured goods, if no one's able to buy services, then businesses can't really function. So this saving at the top actually inhibits the economy rather than promotes the economy, because there's not a there's a scarcity of places to invest, not a scarcity of capital to invest.
So basically you're saying you want the money to be moving in a way. I mean, we're thinking back to Reaganomics, which is, you know, still alive in some forms today, the idea was that you give the money to the wealthiest and it trickles down to the rest of the people. So you're saying, it sounds like what you're saying is that money is not trickling down, that it's kind of clogged up at the top.
Well, I think we need to not try to think about it in terms of either or, but try to really understand, and part of this is what my book does, it looks at specific institutions. So instead of looking at GDP and macroeconomic indicators the way an economist might, I look at particular policies, particular institutions, particular ways the money moves. And in this case, it's not just that the rich have money and it doesn't trickle down, it's that what they do with their money is they do what you or I would do if we had tons and tons and tons of money. We would look for a place where it was safe. We'd look for a place that got a slightly better than average return, like a treasury bond. And it turns out that place is consumer debt. That place is mortgage debt. That place is a place that looks very safe with all this money. And so money could easily be invested in that. And so the people at the top, the big money in the world, not just in America, but around the world, the sovereign wealth funds, were willing to lend people in the rest of the income distribution money, but they weren't willing to pay them money. So that what had happened in the post-war period, the golden age of capitalism from 1945 to 1970, where there was this virtuous cycle of money flowing around through the economy, came to an end. And in this post-1970s period, money at the top was lent to people at the bottom. It wasn't paid to them. And that's part of the story of how income inequality and consumer debt connect.
Well, so what made it so much more profitable to invest in mortgages instead of in manufacturing?
Well, it made it was very seemingly very safe, so that it became very easy to invest in them. And this is part of it connects to the story of securitization. So securitization is a way of turning a unique asset, like a house. Houses are individual. As everyone who's tried to buy a house knows, there's no two houses that are the same. But what securitization does is it takes a large pool of houses and a large pool of mortgages, and it pulls them together so they become almost homogenous, and it enables the income on all those mortgages to be paid out like a bond. It became very easy to invest in these bonds, and these bonds and the sort of wizards of Wall Street were able to do a very complicated thing that we don't need to get into, in which they could split up those bonds into some that were very risky and high paying and some that were very safe and low returning. So it became easy for investors across the risk spectrum to invest in consumer debt, in mortgages, but it turns out that they weren't able to do this with businesses. They weren't able to do this with factories. And so it became much easier to invest in assets that produced nothing, like houses, like consumer debt, than in things that produce jobs and produce value, like businesses and factories. And so because of the securitization, it actually diverted all this money that should have gone into businesses into consumer debt.
And I guess at the same time, you had wages stagnating as well. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. The median male wage has fallen since 1972. This is very surprising for a lot of people, particularly as they watch, as I said, these macroeconomic indicators like GDP. Like, we're told every day that our economy is growing again, yet wages have not gone up for 40 years. And these two, the reason is that the GDP has been growing for those at the top. Almost all the gains in the economy of the last 40 years have gone to the top 20%.
The top 20%. How big a shift is that from what we've seen in, say, the golden era that you were talking about, the 50s through the 70s?
Well, in the 50s to the 70s, basically all boats were rising. That the very poorest saw tremendous gains in their incomes. The middle class grew tremendously. And the people at the top, you know, they were very unhappy because the top marginal tax rate in the 1950s was 93%. So every dollar you earned, 93 cents is taken away. This is part of what led Ronald Reagan to believe in his Reaganomics, because he didn't make additional movies when he was a B-movie actor in the 50s because he wouldn't make any money off it. So it's a funny thing where our intuition about how things work, that if you tax someone too much, they will stop working, they will stop earning, it will destroy the economy, actually is wrong. That if, when you look at what actually happens, it actually helps this economy function much, much better.
So why did it help? Why did that high rate of taxation help so much?
Because the money is diverted from those who won't spend it to those who will spend it. It's about keeping the capital moving in the economy. But I think on some basic level, we're not exactly sure why it all connects. I think that it's something that we need to think about. We need to look at how things actually worked rather than how we think they ought to work. And I think that's where history matters.
Well, looking back at that era you were talking about 1945 to 1970, it did seem like there was a different America there, where if you worked one job, you could support your family on one income and you could pay off your debt. It seemed like a golden era in terms of money. And we're still, I think, operating on the assumption that that's still true about America. But when you get down to brass tacks, it really seems not true at all.
Absolutely. It is completely aberrational. It is the odd period. There's a way in which the post-war has become normal to us. We imagine that that's what we're going to eventually get back to. But really, it was a very special time where you could be an average person, nothing special. You didn't have to be an investment banker or particularly clever. You just had to be an honest, reliable person, and you could go get a job and support a spouse and kids and get a boat and a house and pay your bills. And this was a very different time than it is today. Over the last 40 years, all the rises in household income have come from, you know, two spouse households. It's not from individuals making more money. It's from spouses entering the workforce. So it is a very different time than we live in today, when people are adding second and sometimes even third jobs.
So if you look at the countries whose economies are booming right now, if you look at India, if you look at China, are they doing what we're not? Or if you look at where their money is going right now, is it going into the manufacturing that you're talking about?
Yes, it's going into the businesses. And it's easier, I think, for them to find businesses to profitably invest in because there's so much excess space. It's so easy to find a good place to invest your money in China and India, if you're in China and India. However, in America, it's very difficult for us to invest our money in those economies because there's obvious cultural and legal barriers to putting our money there. places where it would be profitable. And in fact, it would be good for America if we could speed up the expansion of those economies, right? I mean, globalization is real, and if more people in China, India had jobs, good-paying jobs, then it would help American workers, particularly those who aren't investment bankers, those who aren't at the top of the skill distribution.
So it sounds so simple. You're saying basically we need to get back to investing in things like manufacturing that put money back into the pockets of everyone and not just the upper 10%. So why can't we do that? Is it just that it just doesn't pay anymore and we have to figure out a way to make it pay again?
It's not just, yeah, I mean, part of the difficulty is we don't know what to invest in. We have to think back to the 1930s. So let's think about the 1930s. What changed after the 1930s and the Great Depression? There's a sense that it was World War II that got us out of the Great Depression. And it's true in some sense. But what really got us out of the Great Depression was not fighting Europe. It was the invention of the aerospace industry. It was the invention of the electronics industry, which allowed huge amounts of money to be invested profitably. And today, we're searching for that. There's a lot of talk of green technology and green, that is the future of manufacturing. But right now, it's unclear exactly where to put money profitably into green technology. And hopefully something will come about that will enable those new industries to develop. It's the new industries that really enable economies to work. This has happened again and again over the last 500 years of capitalism. So we're just looking for that next new industry to invest in, and that comes from science, it comes from basic research. And once we find it, I think the economy will get going again.
So if you were giving advice to President Obama right now, or before all of before he's implemented what he's already done, what would you tell him?
I mean, I'm very supportive of Obama's pro-science stance, but I think that we need to really think about why in the new federal budget less than 0.5% is allocated to scientific research. I mean, to me, that seems like a gross misallocation of resources. If the NIH and all the other grant-making institutions that support very basic research from which all technological change is derived, and therefore all economic change is derived. Why are we spending so little on science and so much on other things that don't produce economic growth? So I think that's very important. Obama had a idea in his during his campaign that I thought was very clever to get rid of long-term capital gains taxes for investments in startup companies. And I don't think that's been implemented. But that would encourage more risk-taking by investors and by entrepreneurs alike. And I think also that we need to figure out a way to foster an economy where risk can be taken so that people can get the health care that they need to start small companies where we can actually build economic growth out of. And I think that public health care is an important way to do this, to enable Americans to take risks the way that you can take risks in Japan and in Germany and all the places in Europe that have public systems.
We're talking this hour with Lewis Hyman. He's assistant professor in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell University. And he's the author of the new book we're talking about this morning. It's called Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. And we open the phone lines for you now, your questions and comments for Lewis Hyman. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn, and I hope you stay with us after 10 o'clock as we explore the ways in which language shapes identities throughout time and across cultures, talking about the new book called You Are What You Speak. And this hour, we're talking with Lewis Hyman. He's assistant professor at Cornell University in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department, and he's the author of the book Debtor Nation. We'll take our first phone call right now. Joining us first is Dennis from Eau Claire. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I called with this question during the last show about Mythbusters. but they said it was off topic, so they wouldn't quite take it. So I'm going to ask it to you. Is it true that cutting taxes for the rich increases jobs?
I think that is not true. I think that it's a question. I mean, I think it depends on the context. I think we need to not think about this as true or false. It depends on whether or not what the money is done with those rich people. So if there's a scarcity of money to be invested, then it would probably increase jobs because then they would be able to invest it. But that's not actually how things work. That's not how things are in our economy. There's an excess of capital to be invested, and that capital can't be invested in things that create jobs very easily. So, no, I would think that's not the case these days. But I think it's important to remember that it's not just about universal truths about the economy. The economy is itself historical, and you need to take a look at, really follow the money through the institutions to understand what it does.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dennis. And on to Ernest, joining us from Hayward. Hey, Ernest.
Hi. It seems to me that government policy does encourage debt. I grew up on a small farm, and my folks were old-fashioned. They didn't incur a mortgage to build a house. They saved to build it. It seems to me that the mortgage interest deduction of many tools is one that encourages overinvestment and debt in housing, and it turns out it's more advantageous for those who are more affluent. No surprise to that. Those with bigger incomes, they build bigger houses. Seems to me that the mortgage interest deduction, which is a tax expenditure, encourages man to go where man has never went before, at least not as far into debt.
Thank you for your comment, Ernest. And that's something we hear a lot, that the older generations, they didn't get so up to their eyes in debt. Is that true?
It's true that they say that. In my experience of looking at the actual amount of money people borrowed, they borrowed a ton of money, though I have yet to meet someone who has been told by their parents that they actually borrowed. Not to claim that good farmers didn't borrow. But in fact, people borrowed a lot in the post-war period. They just were able to pay back the money that they borrowed. So I think it's very different than today. What changed about Americans after 1970 was not that they borrowed more. It was that they were less able to pay back the money that they borrowed. So that's really what changed. I mean, if you look at not farmers, but the main sort of movement of the American population after World War II into the suburbs, you know, they lived in FHA mortgaged houses. They drove Cadillacs that were, the money was borrowed for them, to shopping centers where they shopped on charger plates. The landscape of America was a debt landscape. In terms of the mortgage tax deduction, what's really interesting to me about the tax deduction was that until 1986, all forms of consumer debt were tax deductible. Whether you was money for a fur coat, whether it was money for a car, whether it was money for your credit card, all forms were tax deductible. In fact, the mortgage deduction is just a residual of that older deduction. I write about that a lot in my book, if you're curious about the history of that and why that is. It's important to realize that, yeah, I think he's right, that it does distort housing markets, distorts choices that we make, and it's something that we really need to question about why it is that we think that every American should have a home that they own. It's not clear to me that that's actually what's best for the economy or for Americans.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Ernest. And to just follow up on what you said there and earlier, that there was this amount of debt earlier as well. People have always been borrowing. But there is this sort of message about middle-class Americans in general, that we are borrowing too much. We're undisciplined. We're lazy. We want things and we want them right away. Is that just a moral pinning that's not true, would you say? Do you think we're being too hard on ourselves for something that is kind of beyond our purview?
Well, I think it's nothing new. I think that people always want today what they want. I don't think that's something new. I think what's different is that it becomes profitable to lend people. So that the problem isn't, in every situation like that, there's a borrower and a lender. And what doesn't change is the borrower. It's not that we're immoral now. It's that lenders can make so much more money off us, so they're willing to lend us more money than they would have in the past. And to keep us in debt rather than just lend us money and then we pay it off. I mean, what's different is that a lot of the lending in the post-war period drove sales of goods that we made in this country, that stores would lend money so that you'd buy the clothes, you know, shops would lend money so you'd buy the washing machines. But nowadays, the money isn't made on the manufacturing of things. It's made on the financing of things. And instead of a means to an end, financing becomes an end in itself. And I think that's the real shift in the economy. And the less we think, the less we focus on our immorality, and the more we focus on the structures of the economy, I think the more we'll understand. It feels good to sort of blame people and say they're bad people, but it doesn't really help us understand why this is happening, in my opinion.
Let's take another phone call now. Let's see. Maria is next from Franklin. Hello there.
Hi. My name's Margie.
Oh, thank you.
And that's okay. And just thank you for this discussion. And what I think is so important is to get people to start understanding the facts and the history, because too many people are listening to sound bites and fear, and I don't think middle America understands how much our standard of living has gone down. Our costs, the salaries that we've been paid. I agree with your guest that it's going to 20% up off the top. And the thing is, when salaries go down and jobs disappear, middle America and lower income, they don't have the money to buy essentials. When the economy goes down, the upper class does not really change their spending habits that much. And as he said before, they tend to put things in savings and in investments. And too much of the economy is not being used to support the middle class, and the middle class is what is by the product. And this has been shown in report after report, and people don't read it. I'm really frustrated at the lack of understanding.
All right, well, thank you, Margie. We're losing you a little bit there at the end, so we'll get our guest in on that, Lewis Hyman.
Well, I think she's right. I think that the standard of living is hard for people to see, you know, what's really changed. Because of technological change, right? I mean, there weren't DVD players in the 1950s, right? So, and I love watching movies, so that those are great, and those have improved my standard of living. But the cost of housing have really gone up. The costs of healthcare have gone up, and it's a tricky issue to figure out whether or not the standard of living have improved. One way we can do that is by looking at the number of hours people work, and the number of hours was falling. From the Industrial Revolution through the middle of the 20th century, but now it's gone up. And also in terms of the real wages, that is, wages adjusted for inflation, wages adjusted to see what things actually cost. And it turns out that people aren't making more money than their parents did a generation ago. So it's something that it's surprising, I think, to a lot of people that Americans are okay with so much inequality, that they aren't fully aware, and it's a question. It's a question that we have to ask ourselves why that is the case.
Well, given the set of circumstances that we have right now in the economy, what advice would you give consumers about how to handle their personal credit?
I think it's very important to realize that a lot of the advice they've been getting is wrong. That since the early 20th century, people, these moralistic people that we were talking about, like to tell you that you should just make a budget and stick to it. Now, the thing with budgets is they feel good because they make you feel like anything you can put in that budget, you can afford, right? But it turns out that the budget does two things. One, that it makes you think that monthly payments are what matter, so that you can borrow an installment for a car, you can borrow for a house, you can put money in your credit card. And it fits into the budget, so therefore you can, quote-unquote, afford it without taking into account the total cost of how much interest you're paying. So then on the one hand, there's that. On the other hand, there's the fact that while you might be able to, quote-unquote, afford what's in your budget, it might it tames your spending, but it doesn't tame the economy. So you might lose your job. You might get sick. There might be downsizing. And throughout this entire post-war period, what made budgeting work for a whole generation, which is why everyone does it today, was that their wages grew steadily, that they didn't lose their jobs, and that the economy was very stable. The labor market was very stable. This is not the case anymore. We move from job to job to job. We see our pay get cut. We are much more unstable in our working lives than we were during this post-war period. And so a lot of the instincts we have about how to handle personal finance was born out of this totally different economy. And it's only by realizing that that people will be able to really take care of themselves.
So that was kind of bleak. So are you saying even if you can set yourself a budget and stay with it, that's not necessarily the best thing for you, that maybe the best thing is to be squirreling away every penny that you can?
No, I mean, it's not that you should squirrel away every penny. I'm sorry to be bleak. It's hard for
historians. It's not your fault.
I think part of the thing is that we're an optimistic people, Americans, by and large, and I think that's great. Part of the trouble was that a lot of us tended to budget everything so that we thought we wouldn't lose our jobs, thought that we would be okay, and that we would borrow as much as we could, right? And there's a reason for that, not just in terms of consumption, but also because when you look at these wages that are stagnating, where can people make money? Over the last, 15, 20 years, it's been through asset appreciation, through houses, right? And whereas Wall Street investors can borrow a lot of money and make money on the stocks, average people, the only place they can borrow lots of money is in houses. And so housing became a way for people to make up that difference in their stagnating wages. And I write about this and how this happened in the economy. So I think that's something to consider as well. So I think in terms of personal finances, we need to realize that maybe individuals can't totally take care of themselves. Maybe they're confronting larger structures that are really beyond the ability of a budget to take care of. In terms of this labor volatility.
It's good to hear a different point of view on that. Let's go to Gary now. Gary joining us from Grant County. Hi, Gary.
Thank you. I'd like to ask your guest, it seems like from what I've heard, a majority of these wealthy people tend to be lean towards the conservative side. And as we know, the conservatives are in a position of power in the government nowadays. And I just have one question to ask, and that is, how far do they want to go? What is it that they want? Do the conservatives want to control all the wealth and have eliminate all of government? I'm just kind of confused on where are they going to stop? It seems like there's no limits to the amount of wealth that they want to accumulate or how much power that they can have over the middle and low class, and I'm wondering about that.
All right. Thank you, Gary. And Lewis?
Well, I can't speak for all conservative Americans, but I can speak to the fact that there's a difference between conservative Americans and wealthy Americans. So if we're talking about 1% of the population owning, the vast majority of America's wealth, that means 1% of the population who are voters. So I think if your concern is that, people on the bottom end of the income scale shouldn't be conservative, that they should vote their economic interests in terms of the wealth distribution in America, then there's a lot more of them. I mean, that's the thing. That politically, they should be able to take care of that. What's interesting, of course, is that a lot of these people on the lower, middle, and lower end of the income scale are conservatives themselves. That they vote these people into power again and again, who foster this inequality. And I think that's a question we need to ask ourselves: why that is the case? Why they're so afraid about losing what they have? And I think this focus on individual responsibility for finance is part of what makes that possible, so that when you have the creation of the 401k in the 1970s and people start to follow the stock market and they become responsible for their own retirements and incomes, people look at their $1,000 they have in the stock market and they think, I don't want to be taxed on that $1,000. I want to reduce the capital gains tax. And so Reagan can reduce it and Bush can reduce it. And average people who have $1,000 or $10,000 are very excited about the money they're not going to be taxed on, not realizing, of course, that the real money that they're losing on taxes is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, for people who have lots and lots of money invested. So this focus on the individual responsibility, you know, exemplified, I think, by the 401k, really helps transform the way in which we think about taxes and the relationship between ourselves as average people and the very wealthy in America.
This hour, we're talking with Lewis Hyman. He's assistant professor in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell University. And he's the author of the new book we're talking about this hour. It's called Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. And we're hoping to hear from more of you this morning. Your questions and comments for Lewis Hyman at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you this Wednesday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Talking this morning with the author of Debtor Nation. He's an assistant professor in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell University. Our guest is Lewis Hyman. And we'll read an email now. This is from Barbara in Spring Green, who says, "It seems to me that this increasing disparity between the rich and the poor and the weakening of the middle class is perhaps the greatest challenge of our country. Yet it doesn't get much discussion, either in the media or among our political leaders. Why is this?" And we talked about this a little bit before, but why do you think people aren't more aware of the income disparity, Lewis?
I mean, this is one of the biggest questions that I think that we're facing, that why Americans think that they are rich, why they think that we are all middle class when clearly we are not. It's one of the things that makes our country so politically stable, that we're all Americans, even if whether we're in Texas or New England or California, but we all are middle class, whether we drive a broken down Toyota or we drive a Lexus. I think that Americans live in worlds that are very circumscribed. So they see themselves, they see their neighbors, and by and large, those people are roughly equal. And the very, very wealthy are hidden out of sight, that we don't see them. And we certainly don't see their bank accounts. And I think it's just very hard to really get your head around. It's hard for me, and I've been studying this my whole academic life, to get my head around the difference between average people and the top 10% and how much money they have. I have a link to, on my Facebook page for Debtor Nation, I have a link to a lot of income inequality information if listeners want to check that out. You can see that Americans think everything is actually much more equal than it actually is. They think that there is rough parity between the top 20% and the bottom 20%, whereas in actuality, the top 20% own nearly all the assets in America.
So when you're talking about the top 10%, how much money are we talking about? Who are these people?
It's a good question. I think that they are people, a lot of the money is inherited. A lot of the money comes from what are called liquidity events, so that when you take your company public in an IPO, you suddenly have vast amounts of money. With Walmart or Apple or things like that. And there's been a lot of that in the last 30 years, a lot of companies going public. And the rise of the IPO really enables that kind of huge amount of money at the top to occur. But I think also there are lots of CEOs, lots of people who CEO pay has gone through the roof in the last 30 years, so that it used to be that CEOs made 30 times as much as an average worker, and now it's 400 or 500 times as much as the average worker, at the same time as tax rates have really fallen. So there's a combination of this stock market IPO finance culture, as well as inequality in pay in terms of wages within corporations.
Do you think it's true that the people that in that 10%, those are pretty much all conservatives, or is that a misconception?
I don't think that's true. In the film that I'm in, The Flaw, it was actually funded by two British hedge fund guys, one of which who was on the right, one of which is on the left, and they wanted to find out what really caused the financial crisis. And so they gave money to a science filmmaker named David Singleton to find out. And my experience of people in the times I've encountered the very wealthy is that they range across the political spectrum. And in fact, a lot of people who are very wealthy realize that your economy needs a more even distribution of wealth to function well. People realize that there needs to be money to be spent by the middle and lower incomes. Otherwise, the economy doesn't work. So I kind of disagree with your caller. I think that there are people across the political spectrum at the top, just as there are people across the political spectrum at the bottom. But I think the real question is, why are there people at the bottom who vote against their economic interests? That's the real question.
That is the question.
Because people at the top who believe in a greater income distribution are not voting against their economic interests, because they think that the economy needs to function well to live in a safe, stable, democratic, capitalist economy, right? So they're not symmetric. On the one hand, so the people at the top who believe in a better distribution are not voting against their interests, to my mind.
Let's go back to our phones now. Jeff is with us. Jeff joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Your guest mentioned trying to find the next greatest thing to invest in, and I personally think that there are certain business and political interests that have been tampering with and squelching developing technologies and trying to figure out ways to divide up too many pieces of a pie of technology, you know, like transportation and energy especially.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jeff. What do you think, Lewis Hyman?
I think that I'm not an industrialist. I am a historian. I teach classes on history. So I don't know where the next big thing is going to be. And I think it's a hard question. I think we need to create the possibility of the next big thing, though. I think we need to create structures, financing structures, that make it easier to securitize business investment than to securitize house investment. I think that right before the crisis hit, there was movements to create securitized business investment the way that we had securitized consumer investment. And I think that'd be amazing. I know that securitization has a bad stink to it these days, but I think that if we can figure out a way for that to happen, and I'm sure there is somebody listening who can, then we can really get things going again. I think that there is a real, I know you said I was being dour before, but I think there's a real optimism to that finance is not always bad. Finance can be used to create new economic possibilities, and I think that we have the ability to do that. So rather than toss out the baby with the bathwater, we need to think about specifically how to help use finance to help our economy get going again.
How fast can we turn it around? I mean, obviously, after World War II, it got a big jump start. What about now?
Things can turn around pretty quickly. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about capitalism. It's incredibly dynamic. I mean, just down the street from me, the last Blockbuster in my neighborhood closed. In only a few years, Blockbuster went from being everything to nothing. That is the creative destruction of capitalism. So I think that if we get the right policies in place, if we get the right places to invest money, then we can make it happen. I think we can do it. It's just a question of mustering the political will, and it's a question of getting beyond this blame game and trying to figure out where America can grow. I think we can grow.
Well, that wasn't bleak. I like the idea that things could turn around quickly. We just have to find the right direction. Well, let's go next to Rod. Rod is joining us from Plymouth. Hi, Rod.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I'm 56 years old, and when I bought my first house, the bank required a 10 to 20% down payment, so I had to save before I bought. And when I got my first credit card, I think there was a 14% cap on interest rates by the state. Why did those guidelines change? How did they change? And will there ever be a realistic cap put back on interest rates?
All right, thank you.
Credit card rates.
And Lewis?
Those are two great questions, and I write about them extensively. So I'm just going to give you a brief summary of why those two things changed. For the first, why did down payments become lower? The answer is that investors were desperate to invest in mortgages. And when you have a lot of people clamoring for something, people tend to provide more and more of it, right? It's just supply and demand. So lenders, the original lenders, wanted to provide a product to be invested in. And so to do that, they had to lower the requirements. It's pure and simple. It was supply and demand, and it was this. This goes back to what we've been talking about for the past hour. In terms of the mortgage caps, it goes back to something that actually happened in the Midwest, the Marquette decision, which allowed banks. It got rid of the ability of states to regulate the interest rate caps within their states by a Supreme Court decision that allowed lenders from other states to lend money to people in other states. So people in South Dakota, where there was no interest rate caps, could lend money. Banks centered place there could lend money to people in Nebraska, and this happened in 1978. So when you got your first credit card, this didn't exist. And then as soon as that happened, suddenly competition between states was such that interest rate caps went away. Or if they didn't, they were no longer viable because you could always borrow from a credit card company in South Dakota. Now, that credit card company in South Dakota turned out to be Citibank, setting up shop from moving from Long Island to South Dakota just to take care, because of that different regulatory environment. So it's both law and it's finance. So it's the state and it's capital trying to make this transformation happening. And again, I have more detail in the book if you're curious.
Okay, thank you, Rod. And on to Chris from Belleville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm focusing back on this issue of why so many of us, middle class or lower economic class, vote against our interests. It seems like either somebody's done a really great publicity job and sort of, you know, called us all into thinking that this is good for us, or that we're victims of something like a Stockholm syndrome almost, where it's part of our culture and we there's a disconnect between reality and what we think.
Okay, thank you, Chris. And Lewis, you want to take another swing at that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge question, the question of why people vote against their interests. I think in brief, I think that people do it because they don't realize what their interests are. I mean, this idea of false consciousness, this idea of, is it just advertising that confuses people? But I think people's interests aren't just economic, right? I mean, I think that people vote not just on their pocketbook. They vote on what they think is right and wrong. And it seems wrong to penalize someone for doing well. It seems wrong say that if someone works really hard and they create a business and make a lot of money, that they should be taken away to be given to people who have done nothing, right? And so it goes back to this idea, this moral idea of who should get money in the economy. And I think that's part of the reason why it comes up. And, of course, there's lots of other issues, guns and abortion and international politics, that lead people to vote for either the Democrats or Republicans. So it's not just about pocketbooks. It's about these moral categories. It's about larger issues.
Part of it that we're an aspirational society, too? I mean, the central narrative of America is this whole pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you could be the next millionaire. That's what the reality TV shows sell as well. So you maybe visualize yourself as that millionaire in 10 years.
I mean, yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. There's this sort of MTV Cribs mentality, right, where you hit the lottery and then you get to live in the glamorous house. You know, I think that what's hard for me to believe about that story is that as you get older, people get more conservative, right? So it's not clear that that's exactly what's going on. But there is definitely a sense that people are very aspirational, right, that over half of Americans play the lottery. Even though it's completely irrational to play the lottery because you won't win, yet people do it every week. So there is this hope that you will get ahead, and that you shouldn't penalize people who do get ahead. So there is that, which is, I think, one of our great virtues, that we're an optimistic people. We just need to figure out how to turn that optimism into a productive economy.
That's a great note to end on. Louis Hyman, thank you so much for your time this morning, and thank you for writing your book.
Thanks so much. I had a wonderful conversation.
Louis Hyman, our guest this hour, assistant professor in the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department at Cornell, and also the author of Debtor Nation, The History of America in Red Ink. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production this morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, with you for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.